Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes a house a home? It's pretty easy to list the attributes we need in a house or an apartment: price, square footage, location, number of bedrooms and baths. But we've all walked into places that don't match our specifications and yet felt instantly at home in those places, just as we've been to other spots that would sound perfect on paper and yet somehow feel all wrong to us anyway. So clearly there is something else required of houses besides their ability to protect us from the elements. Author Howard Mansfield explores that idea in his new book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. He joins us today from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Howard, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. I'm really glad to be here.
Start, if you would, by talking about your definition of the word dwell as it relates to this book.
Well, yeah, dwelling is an old-fashioned word that we've misplaced. It has to do with being in a place, heart and soul, to being connected to the place, to the outside, to making – it's a question of qualities, and it's often a question of a lot of different kinds of qualities that are being squeezed out of our houses. Almost as if we're just squeezing ourselves out of our houses.
Hmm. When you talk about a house allowing us to dream, which is something that really comes up over and over in this book,
yes.
What you're not talking about is the common definition of dream house.
No. In fact, dream house is probably where we go wrong. Dream house is, you know, the bigger house and the bigger house after that and the new appliances and the granite countertops and the big cathedral, you know, all the things that you see on those shows and in the magazines that we are pushed to want. But a dream house, this comes from Gaston Bachelard, a wonderful French philosopher and a French national treasure when he was alive, wrote this wonderful book called The Poetics of Space. And he said a good house is a daydreaming space. In other words, we feel comfortable enough we can just float along with our reverie. We can imagine things. We can kind of encounter the universe that way. We're relaxed. We have room for peace, silence, and dreams. Hmm. That's a very expansive sense of house.
So you've engaged in sort of trying to figure out people and their houses, not only as a house hunter, but also as a census taker. Will you talk a little bit about that experience and what it taught you?
Yeah, I signed up for the census and became a census taker because I had my own set of questions. Obviously, I didn't go off script. I asked all the questions, but you get to talking to people, and you can get to talk to just about anybody. At least I can. Mm-hmm. And what I was really curious about was, are these places nourishing the person's soul who's living there? Is it a good daydreaming space? How is it going with their lives? And you kind of get to go to different places, and people will tell you about their houses, you know, how they came there, how their spouse died recently, how they're having trouble at work, so forth and so on. And you get a sense of how people are dwelling or not dwelling, or whether things are upside down in their lives or not.
One thing you found is that even in sort of grand houses, there's the part of the house that everybody shows off, but then the family lives in spaces that may not be much bigger than the humblest places you visited.
Yeah, we have a long tradition. If you go back to the sort of the Victorian era, there would be the front parlor. Mm-hmm. That would be for guests, and maybe you'd go in there just a few times a year, and everybody would either be living in the other parlor or further back where it was warm around, you know, around the wood stoves or the cook stove. So that's a very typical thing. People, we have these rooms that are really for show, or we feel like we have to have them. But really, no one's coming in the front door. They're coming in the side door. Really, they're living in the kitchen or the kitchen, dining room, open room, that kind of thing, and not in these other spaces.
Yeah, I went to an estate sale not long ago at a very grand house that was built about 90 years ago, and I was struck by the fact that the kitchen was really tucked far away near a back staircase, and I suppose the house was built with the intention that servants would be back there, but no guests would ever be allowed in the kitchen.
Yeah, you have to remember the kind of heat there would have been. It would have either been wood or coal. It would have been kind of a hot, more dangerous place than we think of a kitchen today. It would have either probably been servants or some people came in for the day, that kind of thing. It's a very different kind of thing. And also, depending on the house and the area, there's a fear of fire. So sometimes you find, you know, summer kitchens and other kitchens a little bit away from the structure if possible.
Yeah. So your first chapter details living in your own house when you lost power for a couple of weeks due to an ice storm, which, you know, we actually get those in Texas. They don't last quite as long, but they do knock out the power here. And it's remarkable how different the experience is of living in your own home when suddenly you are without electricity.
Yeah, this was actually, you know, really revealing to me. Our house isn't that old. It's about 1880. It's actually the newer house in the little neighborhood of houses where we live, because the other houses were built after the Revolution. And what we noticed was the entire pre-electric self of the house emerged. Hmm. So there we were. We have a wood stove, which we use sometimes. And there we were back living around our Vermont Castings wood stove. And the quality of the light in the house was different. The sounds were different. There was no refrigerator humming, no Wi-Fi lights going. And the day, the colors of the day, you were very aware of the passing of the light. And particularly at that time of year, it was December, sun's going down, you know, 4:30 or something. And the whole house felt differently. And what it was really a reemergence of the hearth. For thousands of years, we lived with smoke and fire. We used to live around campfires, obviously. Then we moved the fire indoors. In the Middle Ages, you read these great accounts of these big smoky fires in these big open halls, and always in these accounts, some bard is declaiming. And then someone, you know, that just always is. I don't know why. And then someone decided, let's put the fire under a hood. And then someone said, let's create a fireplace. This took thousands of years to figure out, by the way. And then the fireplace was really big. Those fireplaces a woman used to actually walk into, and they didn't really heat the house. They took tremendous amounts of wood. And then the fireplace became smaller. And then it became encased in a metal box, a wood stove. And then for most of us, boom, it disappeared. The fire disappeared. For thousands of years, we're living around a fire. The hearth-centered house is gone. And it's really a huge change. It seems really obvious when you first say it, but and that's what was brought home to me in the ice storm. When this started to happen in great amounts, sort of right after the Civil War in the 1880s in the country, you read all sorts of laments about the loss of the hearth. The Beecher sisters, Catherine Beecher and her sister there, they wrote this book, American Domestic Home or something, Science. And they just have lament after lament about losing the open hearth and what a terrible loss this is, and how they at one point they say Washington and his men did not freeze at Valley Forge so we could sit around, you know, and close fires. So there's, which is crazy. So there's a lot of sort of hand-wringing about that, and I think that carries on today. I think today people feel that loss a little bit, and over time, we've had electronic hearths. For a while, like right after the war when TV came in, it was the television. Mm. And the entire neighborhood would gather to see Milton Berle, right? And then we would disperse from that. Everybody's off in their own room watching computers and different digital devices. And the same thing again has happened in the car, where everybody used to kind of be stuck listening to the same AM radio station or just annoying their brother on a long car trip. And now you drive past cars and the video screens have dropped down in the back, one for each child. Everybody's plugged into an iPod. And, you know, again, electricity and technology is really throws things out. It's kind of, you know, centrifugal, just pushes things out. Does not pull things to, whereas the hearth pulled things to the center. You had to be around heat. And the whole family would be in one room sometimes for the winter. And that was good and bad, depending on the family, depending on the situation.
You know, that's a great point, and you make it in the book as well, that we can wax romantic about the past, but living on top of one another and having to be, you know, 8 feet from the fire or else you were in danger of, you know, losing limbs to frostbite could also be bad. People could fight, they could, and they couldn't really escape one another.
Yeah, there's that, and it's almost like, you think of it like a bad car trip, I mean, for us, but and it's also a sense that the hearth was a mercurial god. I mean, the amount of children who were burned or injured or even killed in these fires or scalded by something there. And the number of houses that used to go up, that's, you look in any town history, that is just there's a river of fire all the way through it. It was hard. It was, you know, a lot of hard things about it.
So, Howard, it would seem like our modern technology allows us to be safe and have these conveniences and feel comfortable, but still choose to be together around that hearth. Why do you think we don't? It's not like we can't flip off the screens and sit together and talk, but it gets harder and harder for families to do this.
Yes, Well, it's a number of things, and I'm sure you've discussed it on the show before, but you have to be really more deliberate about it now. You have to have everybody turn off their devices. You have to kind of really work. It's almost as if in your own home, you're having to swim upstream to kind of make these kind of quiet spaces, these kind of that quality of home that's nothing much, where people are just hanging out, where time, you're just passing the time with people. That's very hard for us. You know, work has come home. Everybody's plugged in. Clutter, the houses are tremendously cluttered now. And so we just have to really work at clearing a space for ourselves in our own homes. Otherwise, I think that's one of the things that makes people a little crazy these days.
Let's talk about clutter, because you point out the fact that houses have long been very crowded. It used to be people had almost zero possessions and a lot of human beings in the same space. And now that formula has flipped.
Yeah, it's actually, we live in today in 10 to 14 times more space than our colonial ancestors.
Wow.
I mean, the average house at the country's founding and in the, maybe the first 100, 150 years was about 700 square feet. That's about the size of a two-car garage. Mm. And it's filled with people, 7, 8, 9, 10 people, family, servants, slaves sometimes, relatives, and very few things. You might have a bowl, a spoon, a bench. That's it. And today, completely flipped. I mean, lots of things and few people. It's a very kind of a unusual situation if you really think about it.
I was going to say, what's interesting is that many, many people will say they're disturbed by the clutter in their houses. They want help getting rid of it. And yet people find it very difficult to part with any of their possessions to make room.
It is. It is. It gets a momentum of its own. You sort of just have to get that first empty cardboard box and pick up, as one declutterer person said, just pick up 27 things and put them in the box and get rid of them. I don't know where they got 27 from, but it seems to work, you know. And then you've kind of start, you push back, you're going the other way now. That seems to be the simplest thing. My God, there's that show? I mean, there's decluttering groups, there's support groups, there's clutter coaches, and there's even TV shows where people watch other people throw out stuff, which is a good way of putting it off, I guess.
Yeah, you get that little reward without having to part with anything yourself.
Yeah. No, how'd they do it? But some of those, you know, when I think it's that clean sweep show, they take out on average a half ton of stuff out of people's houses.
Wow.
I mean, it's incredible the amount of, you know, stuff to the point that 1 in 10 families now rents a storage shed. And there's more storage sheds in America now than McDonald's. Hmm. And the Self-Storage Shed Association, I think that's the name of the inevitable trade group, says that if every American wanted to, we could all shelter under the space of the storage shed. So that's sort of how far gone we've gone on this shopping spree.
It's funny if you even take that word shed, which means two very different things. It means a space to put all your junk, or it also means to get rid of things.
Yeah, and that's very true. And also that idea of self-storage, you always see that word self-storage. Mm. It's almost as if people are so invested in this that they're storing part of themselves, too.
Yeah, and then a lot of people I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
A lot of people will say they can't even remember what they've stored. They just know they still want it all.
Yeah, but, you know, and then a lot of these things that get stored are like wedding presents and things with emotional attachments or thorny issues. It's just a lot there.
What do the decluttering people say about sort of the psychic damage that's implied by people who can't rid themselves of possessions?
They contend, you know, that cleanliness is not only next to godliness, but it's like clearing a space for your soul, clearing a space for you to get rid of bad emotional habits and so forth. A lot of them tend to believe that, it seems. But you know, there are people who are happy in a mess. There are people who are living a good life in a mess. And if they're happy, then fine.
My guest is author Howard Mansfield. His new book is called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Howard Mansfield. His new book is called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Howard, you have an essay in here that I found really poignant, and you write about being a kid, I suppose, gathered once a day around that electronic hearth, the television, during the Vietnam War, and seeing something on television that made you think about an experience that you were having out in the backyard and in the woods with your friends.
Yeah, I was part of that generation of free-range children. I suppose you were, you know, people, they just let their kids go out the door, and there was a lot of farmland, there was a lot of woods around, and we used to play in the woods and all those kind of trails and secret places and adventures that kids have during the day. And there was along this trail this grouping of four or five very old trees, which I think in my memory now are beech trees, and they were made a little sheltered space. So being boys of, you know, maybe 8 or 9, we decided this is obviously a cool place for a fort. You're just naturally drawn to it. And so we started laying up other branches on it until we had like a really great enclosed space. And it's essentially a hut. It's essentially sort of where humans began in different with different materials around the world in this very simple dwelling, you know, a hut. And at the same time, the Vietnam War was going on. That's when I grew up, and the evening news would be on. And there was that famous report with Morley Safer of the GI lighting a hut on fire. You know, taking a Zippo lighter to the roof, and just how controversial that was. And just as those two mix of memories, it just shows you sort of that people had a visceral reaction to it, and then they began to deny it or not and still argue about it to this day. But that is, that primitive hut is always with us, as one architectural historian says. It's an essential kind of shelter. It's a kind of shelter that people respond to when they often have a small cabin someplace in the woods or a cabin on the lake or a temporary hut up here. We have ice fishing. You'll see these little bob houses out on the lake. And it's that kind of thing. You get back to this very simple idea of being sheltered. And it speaks to all of us, I think.
And what was interesting was that one of the defenses of that burning of homes, many of which were homes only to civilians or people who posed no specific threat, they were people who looked at those through American eyes and said, well, that's hardly even a house. It doesn't really count because it doesn't look like what we recognize to be appropriate shelter.
Yeah, there was some commentators were very callous about it. But, you know, if you just showed up and I think knocked over their storage shed, they would be a lot more put out than they were put out about that. They did not really connect with what this was, which was these people's dwelling places and these people's connection to that place and how they were living and just their daily life, their ordinary daily life.
And I hadn't thought much before reading your book at how often, to this day, dehousing of people is used as a sort of tool of war.
Yeah, it's almost like, if you had to sort of get down to the essentials of what war is, it's kicking your neighbor off the earth or kicking your enemy off the earth, however you want to define it. But it's destroying your opponent's or your neighbor's house. It was a big part of World War II. It goes on to this day in conflicts all over the world. Bringing it right home. I mean, that's the true living room war right there.
Yeah, and what's always interesting as well is that when refugee camps are formed, to the best of their ability, with the crudest of materials, the first thing people do is try to establish something that can temporarily at least provide them that sensation that resembles home.
Oh, absolutely. It's also why in disasters people don't want to go to emergency shelters.
Yeah.
Everybody will hang on to the end. It's obvious. It's a very obvious kind of thing, I think.
And even in cases, you write about Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, sometimes people are offered interim shelter or they're offered completely new shelter, you know, a new house that may be better physically than the place they lived before. And very often people are grateful, but they can never quite feel right in those new spaces.
Yeah, it's just not home to them. What that place where they can be comfortable, it has those kind of unnameable qualities of which maybe certainly a FEMA trailer doesn't have as grateful as they are to have the temporary shelter. But everybody wants to go home. I was in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and in New Orleans 18 months after Katrina. 18 months is a long time. I just did some work for Habitat in New Orleans, and then I went over to Pascagoula, where an acquaintance from New Hampshire had started a charity to help people be rehoused, and she was still working at it. And what was so striking, among other things, was how front of mind it was among everybody to try and get home again. And you know that all there is no place like home.
Yeah.
And yet, after Katrina, their home was like no place they could recognize. It taught me a lot. It taught me that these storms are really vast. We get that on the news. We see the huge, pinwheel heading towards the coast. We see the trees bending in the wind. We see the, Red Cross racing around right afterwards. But they're really intimate. I mean, we went to where this house had stood facing the Gulf there on Beach Road in Pascagoula. And there were just little bits and pieces of the former life. And here was that people had come by, looked at, and left behind. Here was one elegant teacup that was completely intact, and next to it was another teacup that was smashed. I mean, these storms are vast, but they're intimate. They're personal. They bear down on you, and they take your life apart. And it's a lot to get up from. I mean, we've all had times in our lives, maybe when we've been sick or we've lost a job or we've had a house fire or something's happened or there's a car problem. Now imagine all that happens to you and your neighbor and your neighbor and your neighbor, and it takes a lot to get up from that, and it takes maybe more than we're even willing to admit to. Our compassion sort of runs out after a few news cycles often, which is the lesson I took away from that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also reach the show by emailing think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I'm a baby boomer. I grew up with parents who went through the Depression, and I think that kind of leads to a mindset of clutter. And then I inherited the contents of homes in my father's family of great aunts and uncles who I actually never met, most of them, and I didn't know much of the family history. And you're up to your eyeballs in stuff, and it's not so nice, but I mean, it's interesting if you look at individual things. So what I ended up deciding was I'm not a museum, and I like eBay. So what I do is research some of these things and then sell them. And so I can learn about the period and the person who maybe used it, but I don't need to keep it. And what I often find is some of these things that date back to the, 1900 to maybe 1940, is that there are people in professions who collect some of these things. So I've sold some of the most oddball items that I picked up at the estates. I had no idea what they were. Music boxes, hearing aids, oddball tools, doctor's things. I've learned a lot about my family, but I'm one of those people who can't afford to just discard it. I need to send it out of the house gradually and get a little income from it.
That's really interesting. Thanks for your call, Maggie.
Yeah, Maggie, it sounds like you've come upon a good way to just keep this stuff from piling up on you and flowing out of your life and making a space for yourself in your own home.
What do you think? I always find it interesting when house hunting, a place can be completely empty, but you can't help but sort of try and piece out who lives there and what matters to them. What do you feel like you can tell about a person, Howard, even if they are not present in a house you're looking at?
If they're comfortable with where they are, I think you can often sense that. There's little hints around how much they really live there or how much they just maybe are just checking in and out, because they have an incredibly demanding job or other family responsibilities that are keeping them away. Whether this place is pleasant, it has a the architect Christopher Alexander has a good phrase for this. He says, we seek out places that are comfortable, ordinary, and profound. Hmm. And I think when we're looking at houses, that's one of the things we're weighing. with those words necessarily, but we're very aware of that. We're very aware of the quality of light that's coming in. We're very aware of the sounds of the rooms, the sense of how settled it is and how calm it is. We're really on the lookout for peace. It's a place to be peaceful, really.
Why? I mean, do you think houses themselves have souls? I don't know if you're comfortable going there, despite the subtitle of the book. I mean, do you think there is something, there's a kind of energy that's put out by particular houses?
Well, maybe not. I wouldn't quite say it that way, but there are places in which we feel more soulful, in which we respond to places that way, so that we're alive. These places are really alive, and we feel more alive in them, and that's the measure of a good public place. That's the measure of a good workspace. That's a measure of a good house. That's what makes them comfortable, ordinary, and profound. We're more alive. We're brought to life by them. We respond to them. We feel more connected to those kind of things. It's a question of qualities, and that's some of the qualities we respond to.
So what can we learn about the best ways to help people rebuild after some kind of disaster from the experiences of people who have already done this?
Well, I think we're what going to Katrina in particular, we're very good about racing in right afterwards and making sure people are looked after. But we have to know that it's more of a long-term effort. We have to know that people have many different responses to a storm. We have to know that there's this storm after the storm in which tremendous pressure is put on families. People feel like they've failed their family often. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they have to take in other family members they can't say no to. That's a lot of pressure. Those kinds of things we have to be aware of. We have to sort of give people more time to recover, and we have to allow them to take that time, and we have to let them, as much as possible, be at home and get them back in their homes as quickly as possible.
And I guess neighborhood is also part of home. So if an entire neighborhood has been obliterated, you might be dropped back in the same physical location, but if it doesn't look or feel the way it used to, it's no longer your home. It's just a piece of land.
Yeah, your community is gone. The whole context could be gone or just severely damaged. It's going to take a while to recover.
Mm-hmm. There are also people who really worry about the fact that we, depending on where we live in this country, we can either really communicate with our neighbors and they can be part of our daily lives, or if we choose to, or if this is the way the neighborhood functions, we can sort of go months without ever so much as waving at somebody across the street.
There is a lot of that, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's a sense that two people can be right next door to each other and be neighbors, and it's a sense that they could each be plugged into something different at work, online, and there's a lot of hiding out. There's a lot of sort of being strangers to each other that's definitely going on, and that's part of dwelling also is that community connection, your house being connected to the neighborhood, you being connected to your neighbors, that kind of thing.
And yet, of course, homes are also places of privacy. And I suppose that becomes especially important when people live in pretty densely populated situations. If you live in a city, you really need a little bit of space that is only your own.
Oh, certainly. That's certainly the case.
Mm-hmm. When you write, it was interesting that you wrote about things like covered bridges and sheds. Can you talk about how you felt that they related to this topic and what they can tell us about the subject of home?
Yeah, I think simple sheds have a great lesson to teach us, whether they're old barns, whether they're little wood sheds, whether they're tool sheds, whether they're saunas in some part of the country. They're very simple. They're flexible. They can be changed and changed again over time, and they step back so life flows through them. It's not about the stuff. It's not about the finishes. It's not about what we're stuffing into it. It's about the life that goes on there. So it's really contra or really goes against the whole idea of the big showy house or the big name architect designing the big space. These kinds of spaces, old churches in particular, all sorts of sheds and barns and covered bridges in their way also, They were simple. They're built of simple materials. You can change them depending on the fashion, and yet their essence remains the same. It's a good lesson for us because the lesson is that it's life that's more important than the whatever architectural detail or finish or big thing that we're after.
Yeah, so it sort of divines down what really matters to us when we stop doing anything to please other people or to be aesthetically pleasant.
Yeah, they're ordinary. And, you know, I think it was Emerson who said one of the greatest tricks of all is to just live an ordinary day well. And what we're seeking when we're seeking to dwell in possibility is the possibility of dwelling well in an ordinary day, just living so that our lives are pleasant and we are helped to others, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, our consumer culture is interesting because we can look at these images of really beautiful places, whether they're large or small, and forget that creating that takes not only a lot of money, but a lot of time that, you know, we might be better off sitting under a tree in the backyard with a book.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of pressure or messages that you need to have the perfect porch, the perfect kitchen, you know, the perfect living room. And you probably going to be happy in the not-so-perfect porch, and you're probably going to be happy in the so-so kitchen. You know, it's a constant come-on by the shelter magazines and the shelter shows to have you push on to the next mountain pass and the next mountain pass after that. And it's also why I think a lot of people who sort of build their own houses often don't finish them, because at a certain point they realize, you know what, we're going to finish this and we're still going to be unhappy. So they just kind of stop.
Yeah, it is remarkable the number of stories you hear about people who finally finish their dream house and then 6 months later they split
divorced.
Up.
Divorced. Yeah. Yes, you see that all the time. It's kind of at the domestic manifest destiny that we are called on to constantly, you know, have a new project, you know, expand the house or add on to it. There's a house here in New Hampshire, in Manchester, New Hampshire. It's a Frank Lloyd Wright house. It's owned by a museum right now, the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester. And it's a fantastic place because the Zimmermans, who owned it, moved in there. The house was once Frank Lloyd Wright and his disciples finished that house, his apprentices, the house was done. I mean, the Zimmermans never had to have a discussion about changing the paint in the room or getting new furniture or maybe throwing a wing on. They were done. They would never have to go into any of those big, big box stores. They could just live their life. And when people go to that house, they're very disturbed by that notion. What do you mean it's all done? You know, you're taking away some kind of birthright of mine.
My guest is author Howard Mansfield. His new book is Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Share a story or your own philosophy of what is home. You can also get to us via email at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Howard Mansfield, whose new book is called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have George on the line now in Dallas. Hi, George.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, go right ahead.
I just wanted to comment that 25 years ago, after about 2.5 or 3 years of research, I built my own log home, and I am as happy in it today as I was the day I built it. It is the most peaceful, relaxing retreat that I can find.
Is it a weekend place, or do you live there all the time?
I live there 24/7, every day of the week.
And what makes it better, do you think, than a house somebody else could have built for you?
I'm not saying that it's better than something somebody else could have built for me. I'm just saying that I spent years studying and figuring out what I wanted, how I wanted it, designed it myself, built it myself, you know, everything about it, and it just, my friends tell me it's a reflection of me. my character. And it really just fits with me. I have my dogs, and I have my home, and, you know, like I said, it's just, it's such a comfortable place for me. It's my retreat when the day's been long and the day's been tiring, and I can go and just escape into my home.
Well, George, thank you so much for that. Howard, it sounds like the perfect sort of home by your definition.
Yeah, it's George had spent a good deal of time, obviously, thinking about what made him happy and was able to pursue it, as opposed to the kind of house hunting that you see often going on where people kind of go in and just count the number of rooms, count the number of toilets, ask about the school district, and never ask really a lot of important questions like, which way is this house facing? I mean, are we going to have sunlight or at breakfast and in winter? You know, what's it going to be like at night? How are we going to live? Are we really going to live in this big room, or is this room going to be for show? What's this big room going to cost us, actually, including interest? All those kind of questions don't seem to get asked. But when someone sets out to actually build the space, I think they do ask these questions.
It's occurred to me, you know, most of us will never make a larger purchase than our homes. And yet you can't really try it before you buy it, right? You walk through for 15 minutes. Maybe you come back and spend 45 minutes and then say, OK, here's, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars. And I hope I'm happy here.
Yeah, it's a great point. You can return a shirt, you can return a book, you can return a toaster, but it's hard. It's, you know, a buyer's remorse for a house. It's a tough one.
Yeah.
and there's a lot of compromises that often make. You know, maybe one spouse likes certain things, the other one doesn't, and then there's, you know, commuting times, school districts. There's a lot of things weighing status, who you think you are, or who you think maybe you want the world to think you are. There's a lot of that kind of weighs down on the choice, obviously.
Yeah, you know, it's when you mentioned spouses, houses are also a place, homes are a place where we are engaged in endless compromise, right, on how to use the space, on what belongs in the space, on who claims the space for a particular amount of time.
Yes, yeah, and to different degrees of success, depending on the marriage, I'm sure.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Edwin in Dallas. Hi, Edwin.
Hi there, Chris. Enjoying your show. Very interesting.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
I had Mr. Mansfield touched on this a minute ago about the but a house should be sort of changeable in a way. And I had the idea, and made me think of Frank Lloyd Wright also, his famous waterfall house in Pittsburgh, you know, how the water running through the house is it's the same river and the same waterfall, but it's constantly changing. And I was thinking about how maybe that's one of the things that makes people so fascinated with the house, and they like it so much. And it also made me think of Walker Percy, the late Walker Percy, the Southern writer. He lived at Lake Pontchartrain and in the, you know, the Hurricane Katrina area. And one of the things he said was the trouble with people is that, you know, the trouble with life is how to get through an ordinary Thursday afternoon instead of, you know, the big thing. How to get to, and he says people are happier in a hurricane. Why are people happier, you know, clinging to a bale of hay in the loft of a barn with a lantern? Why are they happier there than they are at their home, you know? So a couple of things you said made me think of those ideas. So I'm enjoying your conversation a great deal. I'll get your book for sure.
Thanks so much for your call, Edwin.
Falling Water, it's just a great house. It's outside of Pittsburgh. It's kind of southeast of Pittsburgh a ways in Bear Run, Pennsylvania. And the house sits on the falls and over the falls, and it's on many different levels so that as you walk through it, you have this incredible sense of being aware of space in a way that you're not normally. It's almost as if you're some kind of sense that had been long dead came alive. It's also, I think, what people respond to in Covered Bridges often is that they get this great hide-and-seek feeling that maybe they last were in touch with when they were a child, because you're enclosed, but you're suspended over the water, and often you can see the bits of the water either through the floorboards or through the side truss. So it's an awakening. It's a great refreshment, and Falling Water certainly has that kind of great flexibility to it. I wasn't aware of Walker Percy, who's just a great writer, saying that. That's really good. I'll look that up. It does go back to what I quoted you earlier about Emerson. Emerson said, how to spend the day nobly is the problem to be solved, besides which all the great reforms which are preached seem to me trivial. So it's about hunting for the ordinary.
Yeah. You know, I'm always fascinated by the idea of, I think Falling Water is a museum now, right?
It has
not been occupied for some time. Homes that are sort of put on display to show us the way people lived at a certain moment in history or how very important people lived. And I'm fascinated by them, but I find them eerie at the same time because it's almost like they're a simulacrum of a home, but they're not a home anymore.
Yeah, well, there's a number of things going on with homes or house museums. There's 15,000 house museums in the country,
wow.
Which means, good Lord. But when we get that feeling, because a house is really, it's changeable aspects. It's the mail that comes in. It's the children's drawings on the refrigerator. It's that just that in and out of daily life. And then you stop time. You say, okay, this house is now 1842, or this house is about the Alcotts. And when we get in the house, sometimes we have that feeling that we've entered a dollhouse. We've entered a stop time world, and that it's more museum than house. And it's a very uncomfortable mix. And, you know, and then all these house museums have all these different rules. Sometimes they want you to put on those little blue booties.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, there's all these little velvet cords you have to stand behind. Sometimes the house museum isn't sure the story it's supposed to be telling people. So a house museum can be a really uncomfortable place. I do agree with you. But house museums that succeed really bring us closer to that particular era or that particular person or that particular possibility of way of shaping space of living. The best ones, I think, change our minds about places.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Gloria's on the line now in Waxahachie. Hi, Gloria.
Hello, Chris. Really enjoying the show. Always
do.
I just wanted to ask the author if he would comment a little bit about this little trend that I've been reading about lately, especially in interior decorating magazines, about people who are buying the tiny homes that are just about as big a square footage of a parking space, actually, and versus the people who are buying these huge mansions. I myself probably fall in the latter category. Not that I bought a mansion, but when I shopped for my house, I looked for the very biggest house I could find, square footage wise, for my money. I really don't know why I live by myself. I'm just wondering if you could just comment on that a little bit.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Thank you, Gloria. Yeah, the tiny houses or the tiny, tiny house movement, it's quite interesting. People trying to live in 500 square feet, 400 square feet, even less. There are things about it that are liberating. I've lived in small apartments and small little carriage houses. It's sort of great to know that that's it for that house. And you tend to live often more outdoors, or if you're in a neighborhood, or you know more of the cafes and restaurants of that neighborhood. So it has that liberating aspect. Smaller house, less expense, more time for life, if it fits somebody. But it's I think it's a tricky fit. It would be interesting to go back and talk to these people who are in the magazines now in a couple of years to see if they're still there.
What's different about the way people make a place their home when they know it to be temporary? They're, you know, in student housing, or it's an apartment, or a place they don't expect to reside for any length of time.
I think everybody has their little household landmarks that they set out. It's books, it's, you know, pictures, family pictures, it's pieces of art or pottery, or there are a few different kinds of things that you, if you're nomadic or due to, you know, job, or you're in the service, that you absolutely move from place to place. And when that's set up, that's your landmark. That's your axis mundi, your center of the world. That tells you that, yes, I'm home. You know, when you're a student, you put up a poster or two, right? You know, and in our, in one area, you would have set up a stereo, and you know, that's it, you know, and you there you go.
And now I guess it's the iMac and a poster.
Who knows?
I think we have time for one last call. Let's speak with Bobby in Richardson. Hi, Bobby.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call, and
sure.
I enjoy your show. I wanted to make a comment about simplicity of where you live. I came from nothing, and then I did very well, and I thought I wanted all these big trappings. And every time I looked at the larger houses, I thought about what we had was all we needed. And we stayed at the same little 1,500 square foot home, and we don't have a granite top counters or any of those things, and we live very, very happy. And when something new comes in, we make sure something old goes out.
Oh,
and
that's one of the greatest tricks.
Well,
I'm sorry, go on.
And I'm in my late 50s. My wife is too. We have a young daughter, and we're instilling that type of lifestyle into her, and she keeps saying, "Dad, why can't we have one of the big houses like my friends do?" And I go, "Well, your dad's got artificial hips and knees, and he's not going up and down stairs." So I think we just need to be happy where we are, and a lot of people aren't finding happiness because they're not happy with themselves. And I like what you're saying, sir.
Well, thank you, Bobby. It sounds like you've got just a lot of first principles down exactly correct. It just sounds terrific. And the idea of sending something out when something comes in. At our house, we had a zero book growth going on for a while, ZBG. A book would come in, a book had to go out. But those books cling to the shelves, though. Sometimes it's hard to get them out.
Do you mind telling us a little bit about your house? You said I love that you said it's one of the newer ones and that it was built in 1880, because in this part of Texas, that is a very old house indeed.
Yeah, it's a very simple northern New England white clapboarded farmhouse. They used to build them with what they would call up here L's, which is just like you'd have your main house and then you have a little wing and then a smaller wing off that. It's under some big old trees, a big old silver maple. There's a barn that was one time was connected to the house, which was very common up here, and then was moved to the back. I have we have chickens in the barn. We still have a pig in the barn. I have a writing studio in what was the old chicken house, the old chicken shack. It's actually rather nice and simple, just white walls and some windows. We have a few acres. There's a pasture where our neighbors keep horses sometimes. And there's, horses are beautiful. And there's nothing more beautiful knowing that you don't own them. So I just love looking at them. So it's just and there's a brook in the back. I just feel we're very fortunate to live there. We've had some wonderful neighbors. It's a very simple house. It's just old plaster walls and old wooden floors. It's not one of the showy houses that's ever going to be in a calendar or anything. And it takes a little time to appreciate it, I think. The first time you'd walk through, you go, yeah, okay, it's a house. But as you take time to live there, you just realize the qualities of light and the seasons passing. And I think we're living in an era where I think people are doing too much to old houses. You know, they say there's two things you can do to an old house. One is not enough, and then you lose the roof, you lose the sills. And then it's just too much. People just go in with their reciprocating saw running first, and they're just taking things apart before they really know, how does this house really work? What are the qualities of it? And that can be a real loss.
The new book by author Howard Mansfield is called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. We've spoken to him today from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Howard, it's been such a pleasure to have this conversation. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. If you want to find me on Twitter, you can go to @ChrisBoydThink, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.